You know what, Lillian? This answers our earlier question. This is why the driver wasn't listening, because he's like, look, there's a lot of incidences of women standing randomly in the road and men jumping around corners on horses. So I'm just really trying to keep us straight and steady, okay?
I know. This is a treacherous road, and I have been drinking since 9 a.m. I have got to focus.
How goes it, Lillian?
It goes so good, Piper. How goes it for you?
It goes good for me, too. I am wearing a sweater inside my house, which is a big deal because I don't have very good air conditioning. I have air conditioning, but it's not great. So it literally needs to get cold before I can wear long sleeves and not sweat to death in my own home. And I'm there.
Listen, as someone who has frequently been to your home, can attest for technically air conditioning.
Yep, technically.
But I too am wearing a flannel to be cozy because it's chilly out.
Yay! We are in that Jane Eyre mood and mindset.
Yeah.
Spooky atmospheres. Before we dive into our topic today, there are two things that I want to share. One, we made a post online on our Facebook anyway about this. I thought this was just like really cute. I got an email from what I assume is some random website that just makes lists of things. But they did a top 10 Jane Eyre podcast to listen to in 2023, and they released it in September of 2023. So they're like, hey, you got a few months left. But we, Air Buds, was ranked number 2. So yeah. Heck yeah. Woohoo.
We are the second most Air Buds specific Jane Eyre specific podcast.
Yay. We are the most Air Buds specific podcast.
The most of all the podcasts, we are the most Air Buds.
So that was exciting. And then the other thing is, before we hopped on this call, I was taking a little lunch break and just like watching random stuff on YouTube. And this video came up that was recommended by Turner Classic Movies, their YouTube channel. Nice. And it was director Guillermo del Toro recommending his must-watch movies for October.
Nice.
And he chose, one of them was Jane Eyre, the one with Orson Welles.
Nice.
And there's a really cool like 5 minutes of seeing Guillermo del Toro talking about why that story is so classic and why it is important and why Orson Welles was perfect to be Rochester. And so to see a hero of mine talk about a thing that I love was very exciting.
That's so cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, Jane Eyre is just everywhere.
It really is. I bet we could find a way to tie it into everything. 6 degrees of Jane Eyre if we wanted to.
I bet we could make it less than 6. I bet I could connect almost anything to Jane Eyre in 3 connections.
Wow. And that is a podcast that exists in a different reality. But she does do it, and it's amazing. And it is number 1 on the Jane Eyre list.
That's the one that beat us, was my second podcast where I alone sit in a room, think of random things for myself, and then connect them to Jane Eyre.
Incredible. But Lillian, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about the 1970 movie of Jane Eyre with, I almost said Orson Welles, LOL, with George C. Scott and Susanna York.
Yes, we are. This is the one I've been most excited to go back and rewatch, and I waited for this so that I'd have my fresh takes, but it was so good to watch it again.
It was so good to watch it again. And one of the things that I do on the rewatches, so anybody who's ever listened to an episode of our podcast knows that I take thorough notes when we're watching an adaptation of Jane Eyre. And when I'm doing a rewatch, I try to not do that and just watch the movie and see what sticks out to me, having watched it again. And I just love this movie. I love it so much. It's such a fun movie.
I agree. I think I'm going to say personally, I think this is the best Jane Eyre movie. This is my favorite Jane Eyre movie. So I
don't know that I would say best. Mm. The 2011, I think, has some really strong things for me. But I think it's the one I find myself wanting to watch again.
Yeah.
So I think it certainly would be tied up there for me as a movie amongst my favorites. But I don't know. I think it would probably, I think those two are probably tied in terms of how much I love them. But just in terms of like the thing that was really hitting me, especially on this like crisp fall morning, because there's a chance I forgot I was supposed to watch this and watch it this morning, is just like how cozy this movie feels. Like it just like, it feels so nice. And it's, it like is a very soft version of Jane Eyre. We've talked about that before, mm-hmm. but in a way that makes it fun to watch.
Yeah, exactly. I think with the kind of coziness of it. So this feels obviously like lower budget than like a 2011 or a 2006. Mm-hmm. But it's higher up significantly from like a lot of the made for TV movies. We have this beautiful like house that they, and I don't know if the interior is the same as the exterior, but like the main hall with this big mm-hmm. staircase and how it's open two floors. And then all the scenes that we get by the fireplace, they feel like real spaces. I think it is a real house that they filmed inside. It's not a set. And I think that adds a lot to that comfort. Yeah. And it just feels cool to walk with Jane through those hallways.
Well, and I think especially knowing that we're in officially in spooky season now, one of the things that really struck me was how this movie, relative to some of the other movies, like you said, like it does, when we think of it in the timeline, especially after last week, looking at the BBC and like thinking about the fact that like this came out in 1970, which means it came out before the Michael Jason, whoo, almost forgot. BBC, it came out before like most of those miniseries. The only other movie that tried to tell the whole story that wasn't like one of our TV movies was the 1943 with Orson Welles, which did take a lot of story liberties and is like not necessarily trying to be a true adaptation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me in watching this, that similar to what we talked about last week, where it's like, it's just a different way to tell the story that's not necessarily untrue, mm-hmm. is a lot of the movies really lean into that, like, there's a creepy element woven through every scene and every interaction, where this, it's almost, the creepiness is almost more jarring mm-hmm. because it's not, there's this very distinct, like they're in the light, they're in out in nature, they're enjoying each other's company. It's just, it seems like just a straight up and down romance. And then somebody's bed is on fire. Like,
yeah.
And I think that in some ways it's my, I really enjoy watching that. And I think in some ways it makes those like creepy gothic moments like so much more jarring. Mm-hmm. And stand out in a really different way than some of these other ones.
The way you're describing that, it feels as if this is kind of leaning almost more towards sort of like a suspense, or I wouldn't actually call this a thriller, but just the idea that the film is like intentionally trying to kind of lull its audience into mm-hmm. a sense of comfort, just as Jane is, then to like give us these moments of like doubt or suspicion or worry to suddenly put you on edge. And then it kind of strolls away and it's like, let's pretend that didn't happen, but keep it in the back of your mind. And you're like, oh my gosh, let me just enjoy the kisses.
Well, and it's honestly like, I feel like unlike some of the other movies where there's no way to like cut around the spook scares, you could make a version of this movie without adding anything where you just cut out like the burning bed part and like you cut out like Mason getting attacked and the wedding being interrupted, like, and you could have a pretty coherent story that's just a straight up and down love story that's not creepy at all.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be Jane Eyre. But like, I also think, because we watched this right before we read the book, mm-hmm. and I also think there's elements of that that is how the book feels at times, like mm-hmm. there's moments where Jane is thinking about that, where the mystery of Thornfield is kind of lingering in the back of her mind. But in a lot of the adaptations, particularly the 2011, which I think is the one that I compare this to the most because it's another movie. And so it's trying to tell the story in like a really condensed timeline, although that does have almost a full hour more content than this does. Mm-hmm. But I think it, I compare it a lot to that, where there's sort of always a creepiness mm-hmm. to that. Even when it's just these two people talking, there's always something just around the corner.
Yeah.
And this doesn't have this, that. It has them being in love, mm-hmm. and then weird things keep happening.
Yeah. It's definitely interesting. So you already answered like the question I was going to pose, which is kind of like what stands out to you on this watch through. I think for me on this second watch through, one of the things that mostly stands out, and we're going to go into all kinds of details, but the biggest thing is that this is easily one of my favorite portrayals on screen of a Rochester and similarly a Jane. And
yes.
We went into that in a lot of detail the first time around, and we're going to go into it again. But that's my main mm-hmm. thing is that when I think about this, even though they made significant changes from like how the characters are in the novel, mm-hmm. it feels very true to their beliefs and kind of their motivations and their passions. I think there's a deep understanding of these characters that went into both the writing of them and the acting of them.
That's the other thing that I was going to say as well, is I think especially given like now, because we've seen so many adaptations, I sort of have my Jane Eyre timeline and where this adaptation falls. And similarly to when we talked about the 61 TV, CBS TV movie, and I was like, I think the people who wrote this may have actually read the book. Mm-hmm. This one, I would bet Orson Welles read Jane Eyre, and I bet the writer of that adaptation read Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. But I think this was clearly created where everyone involved in this loved the story of Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. And they definitely cut things out because they had to make it an hour and 48 minutes. And they definitely like made some pivots, but so many of the lines are directly from the book.
Yeah.
And they really captured like the heart of Jane Eyre, mm-hmm. and the acting from those two characters. I like that also really stuck out to me. And I definitely think we're going to talk about it in those specific moments.
Yeah.
The other thing that really stuck out to me on this rewatch, when we watched it the first time, I remember liking the music, mm-hmm. but I did not realize that it was
John Williams
who had mm-hmm. done that. And I now listen to this soundtrack. Like, this was the soundtrack I listened to the most when I read the book. This was the soundtrack I listened to when I'm like writing things for our podcast or like working on our social media stuff a lot. I listen to this soundtrack all the time now.
Cute.
And I love it so much. And the way that, particularly that theme, it actually, I've recognized that theme that is like that key Rochester and Jane theme. It has influenced other Jane Eyre soundtracks, I'm certain, because of the way I've seen it come through in some of the other soundtracks. And it's so like nostalgic and cozy for me now. Like, I think that really contributed to my overall feeling of it. And there's like a couple of moments where the two times Jane plays piano, both times she plays that theme.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. And I love the music was so important to me on this one. And the reason I keep coming back to this one when I go to seek out soundtracks, because I've also listened to the 2011 before and all that other stuff, is it really does focus on the love story. And yeah. I think that that's what this movie does as well, is that mm-hmm. it tells the story in service of Jane. It doesn't disservice Jane to focus on the love story, which we've seen before as well.
Yeah.
But this is a movie that is about Jane and Rochester being in love.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I loved that you brought that music element into it, because I feel like we don't really talk about that a lot. So
yeah.
Awesome. So going through the plot and the actual story itself chronologically, we don't need to dwell long in the childhood, but there's a few things I just have to point out. As always, Broccoli is being one hell of a bastard. The fact that he like says during the one, like he's got all the kids gathered and he says, God in his mercy has made you orphans. And he's like, sweet, he killed your parents. It's intentional because you guys need to suffer to be better. When he chops off Jane's hair, he throws the curls at Miss Temple and says, take these relics of Satan, which is fucking hilarious. That's right up there with the pillar of infamy. It's just like so goddamn good. So, and then also, whatever, Miss Scratcher, like, yeah. actively trying to kill Helen. It's just like,
I have a quick note on Broccoli, and then I have some feelings I must express about Scatcherd in this one.
Yeah.
So Jane ends her relationship with Broccoli with the sickest burn I've ever seen, which is she's at Helen's grave. We've just watched Helen die, but Jane is visiting the gravesite many years later, probably 20 years later, based off of how old she has gotten. Mm-hmm. Broccoli comes up to her and is like, hey, we found out that you want to go work for this person. Like, we'll definitely give you a letter of recommendation. But I have some great news. The Board of Governors wants you to work here. And she's like, well, then they shouldn't have sent you, because I respect and like them. And I like what they've done over the years. But you can go fuck yourself.
It's amazing. I had a note about that too, because I forgot that she had that scene with him. And what I think is so crazy about that, because it's like the only time really that I can think of where we've seen Jane like confront Broccoli, apart from like, I think also in the Orson Welles one, she has kind of a moment with him too. But what I think is kind of significant about giving her this scene with him, because we don't have any scenes at Gateshead, mm-hmm. where she would normally have kind of like a, let's show Jane's strength by having her like tell off her aunt.
Yeah.
Be like, I'm not a liar, because if I was, I would say that I love you and I don't.
Yeah.
Instead, they give her a scene similar to that of kind of telling off Broccoli, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. And I think the exact line that they give her, which is so similar in energy, I have not forgotten and I will not forgive.
Yes.
Which is like so good. And I think that's what I mean by like, there's changes in this, but they capture the spirit of Jane Eyre, even in the changes. Like, they have to cut something. And so cutting the Gateshead stuff saves them so much time, mm-hmm. but being able to still represent who Jane is. And like in the conversation she has with Helen, that is from the book that like the talking about Miss Scatcherd, which like that's not in a lot of the adaptations. And we've talked mm-hmm. about so many of the adaptations are in conversation with each other. And I think this stands really outside of that in all the things prior to it, because it's not retelling the movies that existed. It's telling mm-hmm. the story of Jane Eyre. Like, for example, the fact that they focus on Scatcherd instead of Temple. Most of the movies, if they're going to include a teacher at Lowood, they really focus on the relationship with Miss Temple, which makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. A really informative relationship with Jane. But I think what you pointed out with like, well, she doesn't have the reeds, so they focus more on her telling off Broccoli. I think there's a similar thing happening here, where she doesn't have Mrs. Reed as this antagonist from her childhood. Mm-hmm. So if they focus too much on Miss Temple, Miss Temple is so a comparison to the life she had before and the adults she had in her life before, then Miss Scatcherd is more representative of the way the adults at Gateshead treated her.
Yeah. No, totally. And I also think like we have the kind of, you see that Jane learns this compassion and this ability to kind of like forgive others apart from what she says to Broccoli mm-hmm. from Helen. So we don't really need Miss Temple to be also that contributing factor. And so I think they were just really smart about how they kind of chose to trim the fat. Mm-hmm. Not that any of this in the novel is fat, but like when you have to put it into your hour and 45 minute movie, you know, you have to make those choices. And I think they made those really well.
I think they did as well. And I will say I think you hit the nail on the head when you said Miss Scatcherd is trying to murder Helen. Because that's what this is. Like, all the scenes are very much scenes from the book. Mm-hmm. But again, like when you cut them together the way that you do, like her trying to warm herself by the fire and getting in trouble for that, her like not cleaning herself properly in the freezing cold water, her being sent outside as her punishment, like all these things, you're like, and Miss Scatcherd just hates her. And is like, knowing that Helen dies, watching that is like, that is a sick child. And you're trying to kill her.
Yeah. I mean, because this movie, I just realized they don't really talk about like the kind of like plague essentially mm-hmm. that like goes through the school. I think it is kind of meant to be implied. Miss Scatcherd was so cruel to this sick girl that she caught pneumonia and died because of it.
And I think they're trying to really drive home that the school was neglectful and terrible, mm-hmm. which in the book plays off as like all these girls got sick and there wasn't enough food and Broccoli got fired about it. Mm-hmm. But in this show, in this movie, they capture that same energy by having Scatcherd murder Helen.
Yeah. No, it's intense. So I love, yes, that when stupid Broccoli comes up with all of his male confidence and he's like, oh, well, like, you should just stay here and work. And she's like, haha, I'd rather die. Goodbye.
I would love you. I would cordially like to invite you to go fuck yourself.
Yes. I'm out. So you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of like direct lines from the novel in this, which now mm-hmm. we can kind of identify. And I feel like on our last adaptation, we talked about this line that stood out to me that I hadn't really picked up on before that Miss Fairfax says. It also appeared in this one where she talks about how like the Rochesters were wild when they were alive. Mm-hmm. And so now they are like sleeping soundly, essentially to be like, there's no ghosts here. They yeah. were too busy like haunting people in life. So they're now they're just like busy like taking that dirt nap. So it's interesting to hear that line again. And it was cool that that kind of, I don't know, it stood out to me. And it's an interesting way to kind of dispel the idea of like a spooky house.
Yeah. And I think that that fits with a couple other things that because they do the childhood fast. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about the fact that if you do the childhood fast, you do it harsh.
Yeah.
And then they did the framing of Lowood, you know, or the of Thornfields, her transition from Lowood to Thornfield really well. And I think a lot of what they did there was really interesting because they used a lot of elements that aren't, again, like captured the intention without being true to the book in the way that like the 83 is true to the book in that she goes to the post office and she mails the letter and then she gets the letter and then she reads the letter. And then yes. we're like, this was like, okay, let me give you the information without doing that. So mm-hmm. like this, the conversation she has with Broccoli frames it. And then my favorite scene, which is not in the book, was the carriage scene with the world's least helpful carriage driver. Well, she asks him like, is that Thornfield? And he goes, mm-hmm. And she's like, cool. Does Miss Fairfax live there alone? And he's like, yeah. And then she goes like with just with her, with Adele. And he goes, oh yeah. And I'm just like, you know, this is like, you either don't know anything about Thornfield or the area mm-hmm. or like anything.
Yeah.
Or you know, this is Rochester's house and this woman is clearly confused. But yes. either way, you're unhelpful. And what I love about that is it sets it up for her to be confused and think yeah. that it's Mrs. Fairfax's house. Mm-hmm. But how funny that this man was just like, I don't know, man. I'm like, just drive. I'm just the driver.
Well, it seemed to me like, yeah, maybe he was just like trying to focus really hard on driving that carriage. And he's like, please don't ask me questions while I'm driving. Do you want this to go off the road? Because I can't do that.
Listen, maybe he, like the 34 driver, is real drunk. And just the way that they're alluding to that here is by having him just be like, I don't know, man. It's a house. A lady lives there. So does a kid.
Yeah. And I'm driving and trying to focus on that.
I want to keep us on the road because I like my cushy job.
Yeah. So I think their meeting scene is great.
I love it so much.
My main note is, so she walks up into these like craggly hills and kind of pauses to like watch the sunset. And I'm just like, Jane, don't look directly into the sun. You're going to hurt your eyes. Because it just kind of feels like she's just staring into the orb. And I'm like,
but
ow.
I really do love this scene because there's a couple of things that really stand out to me. One, it's absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Is the way that they shoot like her face and the sunset and like just the way she's like really in the moment and in nature. And then the way that they like overplay the sound of like nature and other things and it sort of just gets lost. And then suddenly there's hoofbeats, but it's kind of sounds like her heartbeat and like yeah. all these other things, like so well done. And then Rochester is there and he falls off the horse and it feels chaotic. Mm-hmm. In a way that not all of them are able to capture. Like they yeah. really get that chaos. And then Jane says the funniest thing someone can say when they were staring at the sunset in the middle of the road and didn't pay attention to their surroundings and someone fell off a horse. He goes, what were you doing? And her response was, I was for sure trying to get out of your way.
I wasn't just staring directly into the sun because that might freak some people out.
I was in the process of getting out of your way. I just was also meditating in the road.
What I also love about the location that they chose is like it's all of these like sharp turns around like view obstructing boulders. So it makes a lot of sense that if a man was coming top speed around the corner with the horse, he wouldn't expect a lady to just be standing there. So the whole like rearing and falling off thing, it's very plausible.
Two people who were making a bunch of dumb choices. Because if you're rocketing around boulders, that's a dumb choice to make too, sir.
You know what, Lillian? This answers our earlier question. This is why the driver wasn't listening. Because he's like, look, there's a lot of incidences of women standing randomly in the road and men jumping around corners on horses. So I'm just really trying to keep us straight and steady, okay?
I know. This is a treacherous road. And I have been drinking since 9 a.m. I have got to focus.
So good on him. Yeah, their little interaction is cute. It's like one of my favorite things where they're always like, okay, nope, he's not like pissed. He's just kind of embarrassed and huffy.
Yeah, and like, he's mad. So they don't make him too soft.
Yeah.
Like he is angry and he is kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
But I also like that she goes to get the horse and like can't quite bring it over to him, but she does physically need to help him onto the horse. I think, again, like not quite true to the book, but captures the energy of that moment.
Yeah. And he has this, they're kind of playful right off the bat too. Mm-hmm. Cause like when she has the horse's reins and it's kind of like pulling away from her, he has a line where he's like, what is it with you and horses? Like, which is great.
Yeah. And they do that. They very much meet each other. We've talked about this before where it's really important that there's a balance between a Jane and a Rochester. Mm-hmm. There is not a balance between Zila Clark and Timmy Dalton. D.
Yep.
But there is a balance between Michael Fassbender and Mia, last name I will never learn to pronounce, and Ruth Wilson and Toby Stevens. And I think there's a really good balance here between George C. Scott and Susanna York.
Well, in Timmy D's defense, the reason there's not a good balance is because he's really top heavy. So that kind of balances. Point. It tips
those
the scale.
How could you have a balance with those shoulders, you know?
Speaking of which, George C. Scott is so broad in this. Like, he's got like a barrel chest, which I'm a big fan of. He looks like an old timey hottie who used to just eat a lot of steak and drink a lot of milk. And he proves how strong he is when he literally, later
that's
in the movie,
so gross,
he just like picks up Mason like bridal style to carry him out of the mansion. And I was like, wow, George C. Scott is really trying to show off that he's like not out of the game yet. He's like, look, they're like, okay, George, so in this scene you're going to like escort your brother-in-law down the stairs, and he's like, no, I'm gonna bench press him a few times, get a few reps in, and then I'm gonna carry him down the stairs.
It does feel like a classic Piper potato face. Man.
Oh, I super
Piper
find him attractive.
Loves
I think
a man
so
with a
handsome
potato face. And I think, like, it is hard for me to judge. She's obviously gorgeous. And I love that, like, the only times anybody says she's not beautiful is him in a way that is clearly a joke.
Yes.
But I also do think, I don't know, listeners, you let me know. I feel like he fits the bill of what I would consider an unattractive Rochester.
Yeah.
Because he is attractive, but he's attractive in non-traditional ways.
Exactly. He has an unusual face.
Also, like, I love the idea of you making Sam a like overdone steak and handing him a glass of milk with his overdone steak every night and be like, I need that barrel chest, my guy.
Exactly. Well, I think Sam would be happy if I gave him steak every night. So he would also would not argue.
But he has to drink a glass of whole milk with
yep.
it every night.
Well, it's like, yeah, you got to get big and strong, dude.
You're going to grow up to be big and strong, Sam.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so my next note is about the scene where he gives Adele her present, which, by the way,
yes.
very cute Adele in this.
I have some notes on Adele. Let's talk about her getting her present.
Okay, so my first note about this scene, because beforehand, the only times we see him are in like kind of riding clothes, which is just kind of like a big dark coat. You can't really see much. Then we see him a little more comfortable by the fireplace. And then we see him like the next day wearing kind of, again, kind of comfortable average clothes, helping his tenants, like, you know, overseeing some things. So the next time we see him in this scene, he's got like a full, like, you know, tux and tails, like he's all dressed up. And we see him in that level of attire later in the movie. But I personally am like, I think he dressed up for Jane. Like, I think he's trying to impress her in this scene. He got all fancy. And because it's kind of where he's one of his first moments that he's going to start kind of like questioning her to be like, look, I think I have a good feeling about you and I shouldn't have that feeling. So let's see if actually you're up to handling all my like secrets or a lot of my secrets. And she passes and he has that freak out, which I adore. But I think he's all dressed up because he's like, ooh, I want to talk to this girl that I like.
I do think it's a classic Rochester overthink and manipulate where he's like, okay, I met her on the road. I was kind of a dick. So then I tried to have a conversation with her and technically I was a dick again. But
damn it, Rochester, stop being dicks to girls that you like.
I do like talking to her. So I think I'm going to find a situation where we can set it up so I can hear her talk again, which like that, when you tell the story of Jane Eyre, but Rochester has social anxiety, it makes his behavior make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Because he way overthought that situation. And then he was like, why isn't she talking? She should be talking. Last time she talked. Entertain me.
Exactly. Like he's nervous. He's drinking his wine for his liquid courage, you know? But yeah, no. So he gives Adele her cadeau and he's like, go off and open it in your room so I can be alone with Miss Eyre, and starts, you know, asking her stuff and telling her things. And it's where they, I like that this is again a Jane who straight up to his face is like, is she your daughter? I really love that boldness. I think that's a great way to kind of show that classic Jane strength. And he commends her in the scene for how blunt she is when with her response about like, do you find me handsome? All of that good stuff. And so I love so much. I think this is something we talked about a lot in the first one. And it really stands out to me as like a really awesome portrayal of Rochester's internal frustration with, I think in this scene, he is kind of trying to find ways or excuses to not like this girl because he knows on his conscience he shouldn't. She's younger than him. She's his employee. He's married, all of the above. And so when he tells Adele's story of like his affair with her mother, it's meant to kind of like scare her off and or like make her like look down on him. So he's like, okay, cool, sweet. We now have this barrier. But it's when she's like, no, like the child's like faults are not her, like her mother's faults don't reflect on the child. And he has this outburst. And normally a Rochester outburst is very unattractive, especially if it's handled like a Kieran or a Syrian Hines. But what I kind of love about this is that it's a brief moment and he shouts and he's like, have you none of your own? Like when she's talking about, you know, the faults of the mother. And it's like, it is like an inappropriate thing to do with another person in the room, but it's such a good glimpse into like, he has this kind of stone cold facade that I think he's trying very hard to maintain. And for a brief moment it cracks. And then he like is embarrassed, composes himself, and he's like, you know, okay, I guess we're done here. I just, you know, showed kind of my cards, my hand a little bit, whatever. But I just really love that it is this moment of him kind of being like, damn it, I'm trying so hard not to like you, but you're saying all the right things.
I also think it's this constant layer of Rochester has been disappointed so many times by every woman in his life, every person he's cared about, really.
Yeah.
Has burned him hard. So his like interrogations of her, his wanting to like dig more into like, okay, who is this person? Especially a person he has good feelings about. He's like, can't trust that. Gotta dig into this. And the more that she does and she seems perfect over and over again, the more that he's thinking about like Bertha, who seemed perfect and then wasn't. Yeah. Or Celine, who seemed perfect and then wasn't. And the knowledge that he isn't perfect. So it's this thing of like, you're looking for flaws because you're expecting to find them. And then you're not finding them. And then you feel less worthy. And you don't feel like you're worthy of that love. And that just makes you real angry. And then you're like expressing this vulnerability, being like, hey, like you probably are going to hate Adele now because of this. And then she comes back with, well, that's like not her fault. And it's not an opening to allow him to be able, like, it's, she's not coming back with being like, you know, all people sort of have sex. I've done things I regret. Because I think if she said something like that, he would be more likely to be like, ah, okay, so we've all done things that we regret. And instead it's like, no, she had a response that made me like her more, but also didn't show flaws to me. So I can't show all my cards.
Yeah.
Which would be really infuriating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, like, because in the novel, you know, they talk about how, like, he has this kind of temperamental nature, and it's difficult to, you know, portray that well without mm-hmm. him coming across as a total, like, douchebag. Mm-hmm. And so I think this, like, one little moment, because everything else with him is very composed and kind of quiet. And this is the one kind of, like, outburst that we see. And I think that just that little glimpse, and then it kind of, like, goes back. He tucks it away again, and then mm-hmm. kind of puts back on the, like, element of, like, I am the master of this house. I am in charge of all these people's safety and responsibility. So I have to go back to, like, being in control, even though probably I want to, like, scream and shout and mm-hmm. do other fun things, but whatever.
Well, and I also think there's a layer of, like, it shows that we've, because we talked about this when we talked about it the first time, of, like, it's an outside of, it dances on the line of, like, is this scary? Mm-hmm. Like, is this a sign of abuse that you should be worried about? And I think the way he responds to that of, like, damn, that was not okay of me.
Yeah.
Shows that, like, that's not, like, instead of his reaction to being angry, to be like, to blame her, and to be like, it's your fault that I just broke this glass and was an asshole. Mm-hmm. To be like, I should probably be done. Like,
yeah.
That's a much better reaction. But I do want to talk a little bit more about Adele if we don't have anything more specifically about this scene.
Go for it.
Okay. I have notes about Adele because I think that she, first of all, she's a great Adele, but there's a couple of kinds of Adele that they have play in these movies. There's Adeles that are hired just to be cute and props. Mm-hmm. And then there's Adeles who are hired for their, like, acting ability. And sometimes they're less cute and more annoying. Mm-hmm. But I think those Adeles are a little bit more accurate to the book. We're mm-hmm. like, this Adele is a cute, sweet little prop. Like, she is the cutest little girl. And she kills it with the French.
Yeah.
But she is just a cardboard. She's very sweet, but she has they toned down a lot of Rochester shit talking about Adele, because if you talk shit about this little angel, what an asshole.
I know. Yeah, I like when we first see them in the fireplace, like, she gives him a little, like, kiss on the cheek goodnight, and he's just kind of like, all right, bye. And yeah, he doesn't really, like, make fun of her the way he does normally mm-hmm. in other versions. At most, when she runs off with her present, he's just like, oh yes, a true child of Paris, and talking about that stuff. But it's like, we haven't seen anything from her performance to imply that, apart from her just being a cute little girl who wants a present, because every little kid wants presents.
And he promised her a present. So you ask about it every day until you get it.
Yeah, exactly. No, but she's adorable and very likable. And yeah, how could anyone not want to take them into your house?
And I know we talked about this last time, but I went back. I was, like, checking on something and missed this moment, so I went back to rewatch it. When Adele and Jane have trade sick burns again, where Adele is like, don't you wish you were pretty? And then Jane is like, don't you wish you could draw? Let's not sign it until we're a little better.
So good. I love it. So my next notes are about the burning bed scene.
Yes.
Are you ready to talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's like, fire-wise, I think it's filmed very well. He does, like, get up and assist. But I think one of my favorite things about this scene is more so in this one, he doesn't leave at all to go investigate. They just kind of stay in the room. They just kind of talk with one another. And it's a lot of it is spoken through just kind of the looks in their face. They don't really do the, like, him holding her hand kind of a thing and her being like, oh, I need to go, I'm cold. It's more of, like, an unspoken kind of, like, you can tell through their great, you know, subtle performances and also the looks in their eyes. And I think the two main things that stand out to me is after Jane leaves, the camera lingers on Rochester's face and George C. Scott gives this look that you can just, at least the way I interpret it, like his inner monologue is just like, that's it. I have to do something about this. Like I really like this girl and I can't just tell her that. So I have to figure out something to make her like come to me. I just have to do it. And then we get a similar moment of Jane in her room where she like, you know, has this kind of like, she puts her arms around herself and she looks very like kind of bashful and nervous and happy. And so without saying some of the crucial lines that we normally have, both actors are able to convey those crucial feelings.
I think it's the same thing that George C. Scott Rochester moment is the same level of like subtle, incredibly well done acting that we see from Jane the next morning when she's like putting those final touches on her outfit. And she's very like, it's the first time we see Jane care about how she looks. And she cares in that way that like is so recognizable as a woman going out when you're going to see your crush and you're just like, okay, I got to have this just right. And then I got the, and I'm wearing my best dress. And then like the level of disappointment when Mrs. Fairfax says he left and you just want to be like, no, okay, so here's the thing, Jane. This is going to sound crazy because it is. But he doesn't, he didn't leave because he doesn't care about you. He left because he's an idiot. And he does care about you and he thinks the best way to get you to care about him is to make you jealous. And that's stupid, but he has social anxiety. So being vulnerable and telling you his feelings seemed like a bad plan to him.
Exactly. And every relationship he's ever had involved a woman either trying to kill him on his wedding night or cheating on him and running away with the jewels that he just bought her. So he doesn't really understand trust.
She didn't try to kill him on his wedding night.
That's what, there's a line in this movie. He says that. He's like, I didn't know anything was wrong until our wedding night when she tried to murder me. So
that's
like,
incredible.
He's like, sweet. I can't wait to make love. And she's like, what about a knife? And he's like, no.
Have you, you know what I like? Knife play.
And he's like, oh, I don't know if I like that, Bertha. Safe word.
This man is far too sweet for that.
Okay, so my next thing, so he starts enacting the plan, bringing the party here with Blanche and everything. Hearing him sing as Blanche plays piano, it put an image in my mind that I was like, oh my God, what if like, later on in Jane and Rochester's life, when they're married, can't you just see them at Christmas time? Like she's playing Christmas carols and he's singing and it's so cute. I just had an image of that and I was like, oh my God.
I totally see that.
It's so beautiful.
I think speaking of like the whole party situation, I think I really liked how they handled the house party for this. Again, like they caught the spirit of it without making us watch the world's most bizarre game of charades. But what I really enjoyed was I like when they make a Blanche human and not just like a vicious bitch.
Yeah.
I like that she had a real, like what looked like a real relationship with Rochester. This is one of the ones that gives me sympathy for Blanche in a way that I just don't have in some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's necessarily true to the book, but it is a way that I find really interesting where it's like the conversations they have, there's allusions to things that are true in the book. Like there's not exactly this conversation, but there's a conversation that's so similar to her being like, I don't think a man should be pretty. I think he should be ugly and strong.
Yeah, like a guy who eats steak and drinks milk and can bench press his brother-in-law.
But I think that they do a really good job of that. And I think like she talks about wanting to change Thornfield and how she wouldn't change him because like all these other things. And I think to her, and the thing that makes her sympathetic is like, some of that is like flattery and somewhat manipulative, but I've always seen Blanche, particularly in adaptions like this, as more of like a practical negotiator.
Yeah.
Like she's not going to pretend that she's in love with him, but she cares about him enough that they could have a business arrangement where they're married and she takes care of the house and he does whatever it is that he wants to do.
Yeah.
And I think she's demonstrating that she likes him enough that she'd want to do that.
Right. Because in this, we don't have like scenes of her like plotting with her mother or anything like that. So we don't have this like malicious intent. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just like, if you just view it as is, I mean, she is an eligible pretty woman who was mm-hmm. invited by this guy to like have a party at his house, and he's like dancing with her and singing with her, and so she's like, okay, cool, he's into me, I could make this work, let's do it. So she's just like mm-hmm. meeting him halfway, which I think is like totally fine and reasonable. So,
and I think the reason it works even with this soft Rochester is because he doesn't drag it on for as long as he does yes. in some of the other ones, which we can talk about Mason if we want to, but they do wrap that up pretty quick.
So what I think is so great and telling about that, kind of what like you like this mm-hmm. leads in well to like what you just said, is that so I think when Jane can't stand to watch the man that she loves sing this romantic ballad with this pretty woman, so she leaves and he instantly goes after her. They have a really cute moment on the stairs when she's crying, and like again, a great performance from Susanna, because like you know that if she like tried to explain, she would just break down and start crying. So she just like, she's like, nope, I'm not gonna even say anything. And he sees that and he's like, okay, I see I've gone too far. It's like, you go to bed, I'll see you tomorrow night. She's like mm-hmm, and just kind of walks away, and it's very like understanding on both sides. But then what's so great is that he goes back down the stairs, and at first he goes to go like re-enter the ballroom with the party, but he stops and then he's like, no, pivots, and then just goes outside. So it's like, the only reason he's doing the party is for Jane's like effect. And if she's not there to see it, he's like, no, I'm not going back into that party. I don't care about these people. I just care about Jane.
And that reminded me of another line that I know we talked about last time. I don't care. I loved this line where Jane is taking Adele to bed, and Rochester and Blanche are talking about it. And somehow Blanche says something about like, what a plain, strange little thing. And he goes, I think she's pretty. And then Blanche is like, oh my God, I was talking about the governess. And he was like, oh, right. Yeah, I was defending Adele for sure.
No, it's so dang cute.
No, for sure. I wasn't talking about the governess. I was defending Adele.
This movie is so romantic, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's like my top favorites. I just realized it's really clever that instead of any kind of like a gypsy scene, they have a scene where like Rochester is essentially doing tarot cards with his guests, which I think is a kind of an interesting way to like kind of mm-hmm. do a nod to that, to the audiences that would know the story well, to be like, oh, he's fortune telling, kind of. Huh, interesting. So that's kind of an interesting choice of how to sort of nod to that.
Yeah, we can definitely cut this out, but we have told people that we would stop saying gypsy and we'd say fortune teller, because mm-hmm. we shouldn't be saying gypsy anymore.
Gotcha.
So just a heads up.
Sweet.
I liked that scene as well. I thought that was interesting. I think it's similar to like what I said before, where there's a lot of things where they're just like alluding to the similar thing. Right shortly after that, or maybe it's the next day, is when they have the Mason scene. And what a little creep. I don't know how they did the cast. The casting director on this deserves some sort of award, because really well done, including a little creep, like a frog come to life.
It's very froggy. Yep. Just there to ruin Rochester's time.
And he's just bad at stuff.
Yep. But gets attacked in the night. Everyone comes out in their cute little like floppy sleepy hats and their robes. And
Rochester does a great job of just being like, you guys, one of the servants got drunk and we're trying to deal with it and just go to bed. And all the men are like, oh, what been there? Yeah. I've started screaming in the middle of the night because I drank a bunch of port.
No, it's so great because I love the way he like kind of spins that around to make it something everyone's like, oh, yes, we did get rowdy last night, didn't we? It's awesome. But yeah, so she helps him out with that. And I like, this can be challenging, but I think they did it really well in this one when they just simply do from the moment, because again, we don't have her going back to Gateshead. That whole element is not in the story. So Rochester, after carrying his brother-in-law to the carriage, drives him into town himself. Rochester doesn't put him in a carriage. takes care of him, as we love mm-hmm. to see. And then Jane like paces all night in the garden until he comes back in the morning. And it's in that scene when we kind of combine a few things mm-hmm. of like, you know, sort of the first sit in the garden, giving her flowers and being like, oh, like, will you sit with me again before my wedding? But it's now kind of this moment of a little bit of that like teasing, but it's not really like, I think what I like about this one, when he's not like directly being like, oh, don't you think Blanche is good for me? He's just kind of making vague references to like, okay, so pretty sure I'm going to get married and I don't want to live in this house when that happens. And Jane is the one filling in the blanks with her own mm-hmm. self-doubt of being like, oh yeah, I guess Adele will go to school and I'll have to leave. And he's like, oh, that's what you're still there. Okay, sure. What do you think of Blanche? Like, so those kind of things I love. I think they did that well. They mixed those scenes together.
Yeah. And as I said before, like as soon as she gets upset, if you're not going to do the gate set thing, as soon as she gets upset, he has to be like, whoops.
Yeah.
Let's get married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which does feel like it happens a little fast, but it's okay. Like, I don't mind.
Well, it does happen fast. But again, like they do a whole she leaves and goes with St. John. If you're going to do that, you got to just keep going forward. I also think they do a good job. They have a Bertha coming in to steal the veil. Then they, to get to the wedding, they go right to Mason showing up at the house being like, I have mm-hmm. to talk to Rochester. And then cut to the wedding scene.
So I do have to say real quick, one thing that stood out to me about the veil scene with Bertha that I think is another wonderful detail of making Bertha a sympathetic element of this story mm-hmm. is the fact that in a lot of other versions and in the original novel, this is like meant to be kind of threatening towards Jane, where Bertha comes in, she holds the candle close to her face, she rips the veil. It's mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And it also is typically set up as a final like opportunity for Rochester to gaslight Jane and lie to her face. But because we don't really have that follow-up of those questions, we don't have that lying element from Rochester, which again makes him more sympathetic. But the thing that I think is so interesting about this scene that makes Bertha even more sympathetic is Bertha is like in this room, she's looking at Jane, she sees the veil, she puts it on her head, she looks at herself in the mirror. And then when she hears Jane start to kind of stir, Bertha flees, she runs mm-hmm. away, and the veil just falls. And I'm like, okay, so here she's not this like violent, vindictive monster, she's a frightened, confused person. Yeah. And I think the fact that she runs and it shows that she's like easily scared and, you know, doesn't have her wits about her. And it makes her all the more sympathetic when we see her later on.
Yeah. This is a deeply sympathetic Bertha, but not in a way that makes Rochester an asshole, which is a really hard line to walk.
Yeah. And they did that.
They did it so well. There's then like a very fast interrupt the wedding scene. Mm-hmm. In general, I know we've talked about 70s fashion being very strong, probably the strongest decade in terms of you can't keep it out of a period drama costumes. They have that a little bit in like some of the coloring of things. Mm-hmm. But the place that I see it the most is in her dress, her wedding dress.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think they did a pretty good job of not letting the 70s fashion overwhelm everyone. Mm-hmm. They've also got really great bonnets. Just my quick fashion notes.
They cut to Miss Fairfax, she looks like she's like the holy like mother superior with like it was this like white halo of frills around hard, her face.
It was real hard to take anything she said or did seriously with that bonnet.
Yeah, it's a lot. But yeah, then we have a scene that we've talked about a bazillion times, mm-hmm. so I don't feel like we need to dwell on it. Still probably my all-time favorite seeing Bertha scene and stay mm-hmm. speech scene. Again, like she attacks him and he just kind of like lets her do what she needs to do. She doesn't actually scratch him. So that kind of implies this sense of like, they've been through this enough times. He kind of maybe knows. He's like, look, she's going to probably jump on me and growl at me. But if I just don't fight back, she's not actually going to hurt me. And she doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I love when he helps her up, like he then brushes the hair out of her mm-hmm. face. It's very tender and caring. When they're down on the ground, Jane crouches next to them, which is so I think that also shows a level of understanding where normally Jane is at the other side of the room and she's running the first chance she gets. And in this, she does leave mid his speech, but we see the compassion that she has for this other human being. She's not animalized. She is a person. And so I love seeing that understanding and compassion from all the other characters in the scene.
And I think something that we talked about a little bit in the first episode of this, but I think you see, I really saw through this whole adaptation, but particularly in these two scenes with the Bertha scene and then the stay speech, which if we talk about every episode that we talk about those things, we talk about this movie. So we have talked about them quite a bit in depth. But I think what really stood out to me on this rewatch was this is, in general, Jane Eyre is the story of a 19-year-old and her 35-year-old boss. Mm-hmm. And there's moments when that really stands out in the book. Mm-hmm. In this adaptation, this is a romance between two adults.
Yes.
Like, they are much more on actual equal footing.
Yes.
Age-wise mm-hmm. and, like, maturity-wise. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that really stands out to me in the Bertha scene. And then it really stands out to me again, because the way that Jane leaves the room in this doesn't feel like she's scared. It doesn't feel like she's like not unable to like get from point A to point B of like, I get why he did what he did. Like, she gets there, mm-hmm. but she's already at the end of the story, which is, I can't stay here with him. So her leaving isn't about not wanting to be with him, not seeing the value of him. Like, her leaving that room in that moment is about her seeing this person, realizing that it doesn't make her stop loving this man. She's mm-hmm. not angry. Mm-hmm. She's devastated that she loves him possibly more and still feels she has to leave.
Yeah. I think there's so much in the conversation that they have before she leaves that just really speaks to what makes that moment in the book so powerful and special. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea of, like, it's all about Jane's self-respect is kind of what it comes down to, where she's like, yes, no, I understand your situation. I know that you love me and I love you too, but I can't. I think the line that I love that she uses in this is like, she's like, I won't be your mistress. I won't sneak past your wife to take my place in your bed. Mm-hmm. And he comes back with all of these arguments that like you could easily get behind of him being like, she's like, no, there would be like, all the rights would be on your side and not on mine. And he's like, everything that's mine is yours. He's like, that's what society says. That's not what I say. You and I know better. We are on the same playing field. And it comes down to this personal internal mm-hmm. choice. Of being like, I would forever know that she is around and I mm-hmm. can't disrespect her that way and I can't disrespect myself that way.
And I think what they do so well in this, that is what comes out of every great stay speech and what comes out of every great deeply human conflict and is so real mm-hmm. is at the end of that scene, I think they're both right.
Yeah.
Like, they are both right. Mm-hmm. She's right. She has to leave. She has to do what's right for her. She can't stay there with no power and no control. She would lose all of her freedom. She wouldn't be his equal. And you can't have a relationship like they want to have without equality. Yeah. And he's right in that they would have equality of who they are as people. Mm-hmm. And isn't that what matters in the end? And they're both right. And I just, it breaks your heart. Mm-hmm. In the best way.
It's so good. I honestly think this is like the best stay speech we've ever seen, in my opinion. It's my favorite.
I think certainly on, I think I wouldn't say I, it's definitely up there. I think I like, if we want to talk about like delivering all of the lines, I actually think the 83 is killer too.
Oh yeah.
But the one that I would say, the one that I would say is truly my favorite is the 2011, because I think Michael Fassbender does such a great job. And I think that's the one that feels the truest to me of like, Mia feels 19 in that. And yeah. that is how old Jane should feel in that scene. Yeah. I like this version of this. I mm-hmm. like these two adults having this conversation and really arguing it to the points of mm-hmm. what is happening here. But what makes – what gives the 2011 to me an edge is the fact that they feel more the age of the characters and they feel like they have the flaws the characters have to me.
Oh,
where
totally.
These – that this is one where it just it's a little outside of
yeah.
what Jane Eyre should be to me.
No, for sure.
But I love it. It's still fantastic.
It's my personal favorite.
Yes.
And I think the ideas that it explores and the time that it has yeah. taps into that true feeling of that scene.
Yeah.
But so she wanders. She's found by the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with St. John, who is not attractive at all. Not in personality or in face.
Or in face.
He is not handsome in face.
I doubt he's ever had a steak and a glass of milk, you know?
No, I don't think so. He just eats potatoes and mushrooms that he finds.
Here's a question I have about steak and a glass of milk. Man, he wasn't trying to do an English accent, right? He was just doing an American accent.
I think he was doing a fancy accent because there were definitely some times where the ends of his sentences were punctuated with a definitive Americanness.
Yes.
But I don't blame him. Who cares? He's still great.
Yeah.
So St. John is the worst, as always.
He's so terrible. I will admit to the fact that I needed to cut down some time on my watch time this morning, and I did go, look, St. John's here. Just skip forward.
A bunch. So I'll just cover real quick. Hilarious that one of the sisters is trying way too hard to be matchmaker with Jane and St. John, where she's like, no, St. John, give Jane a kiss too. And he's like, no, none of them are into it. And then it's just like super awkward. And she's like, isn't this nice? Wouldn't it be cool if you guys were together? And they're just like, stop muddling. St. John's kind of like, wait, actually, I kind of like this idea. The fact that when he's giving his sermon in church before he then like assaults Jane with an awful proposal is that he's just like saying a kind of a lot of the stuff that he says in his speech in the novel when he's trying mm-hmm. to get her to like marry him, but he's saying it in a sermon. So it's like even weirder. It's kind of like if somebody's trying to do a big grand romantic public proposal, but the other person's not into it. So he's got it up on the Jumbotron and he's like, hey, you're not made for love. You're made for labor. What do you say, Jane? And then like he meets her after church. He's like, did you hear my sermon? And she's like, well, you were screaming it at me. So yeah, I heard.
I will also say I thought it was particularly funny to imagine being someone who wasn't Jane
yes,
in that.
Right.
Like, can you just imagine, like, it's Sunday morning, you're there with your kids, your husband is so boring. You have to sit through this church sermon, and then you're just like watching your preacher, pastor, whatever, who like you've kind of always gotten weird vibes from. And he's just screaming at this lady who, like, you know, works for the church. And you're like, this is really weird.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
Super weird. When you're in a, like, a staff meeting and you can tell the two people who have hooked up at work who shouldn't have are, like, having a kind of subtle, unspoken fight in the meeting. And it's just like, oh, God, you guys, take it outside.
This is why we have HR.
Yes. But then he, like grabs her and is like, he's like, yeah, you're gonna be with me, and it's very forceful, and I'm just like I literally wrote down and said out loud, I'm like, ew, he's so desperate and like actually clingy, like he's like grabbing
yeah.
Jane and like trying to hug her to him, and she's like, okay, no means no, you idiot, get off of me. Luckily
I
the voice
love...
comes in
yeah.
and saves her.
I did watch that part of the scene, and I think the speech Jane gives to him, while not accurate to the book, I think it's accurate to how she felt. And so like, it's one of those, this would be an internal monologue, but it's an external one. But I kind of love the idea of like, Jane in the book doesn't give a shit that he thinks she's crazy. She just sort of like wanders away. But I think it's funny to imagine Jane being like, no, you suck. Mm-hmm. You're the worst. What you believe in is actually all bullshit. Goodbye.
Well, I went back and I wrote down this quote of her response, because I actually thought it did a really good job of kind of tapping into sort of like some of the I wanted to say philosophy, but it's what is
theology?
Like, yeah, theology, kind of like themes of Jane Eyre, when, like, as she's leaving him, you know, he tries to shame her into submission by coming back, and he's like, you're turning away from God or whatever. And she's like, stops, turns back, and says to Sinjin, she's like, no, I'm finding him in people and in the love that they have for each other. You cannot love just God alone. And yeah. I fucking love that, of her being like, look, you think you, like, memorizing the Bible makes you the best God boy ever. Well, actually, you're not living life or doing any of the things it's telling you to do. So you suck. And I'm going to go find God by loving the man that I love.
I'm picturing Sinjin with one of those, like, office style mugs that says world's best God boy.
Yes. I'm head God boy.
Oh, that's so great. And then we have the best reunion scene. It's just the best reunion scene. It's really so cute. Good.
Yeah.
First of all, Pilot plays a key role in it, as he should.
Yeah. That big Great Dane.
They're out in a garden. They're both dressed so cute. They both have such emotional reactions to seeing each other again. Jane really does a trick on him. The fact that she, like, says he thinks she's getting married, and he's like, tell me when the wedding's going to be. I'll make sure Adele comes back from school. Like, he just is so in love with her that he would go to her wedding to someone else because he just wants to be in her life.
Yeah.
And yeah, Rochester would never do that, but that's so sweet.
I know. It's really cute. And I love, like, he puts his hand on her face and he can feel her tears. It's just like, oh my God. It's so dang cute.
Yeah.
Love it. I was slightly distracted by the trees behind them because they looked like redwood trees, which I'm like, did they film? Because I thought they filmed this, like, in the UK, but if they filmed it in America and it's in California, then that would make total sense because those look like redwoods to me. And I feel like redwoods only exist in California or, like, Northwestern America.
What is a tree doctor? Is that what it is? If you're a tree doctor and you listen to the show, go check that out and let us know.
Cool. Anyway, I am ready to give my rating. I don't know about you.
I am also ready, but you go first.
Okay. I am going to rate this, just personally, for my own fuzzy happiness. This is a 10 out of 10 George C. Scott's.
I was feeling like you were going to rate it a 10 out of 10. Your previous rating was a 9 out of 10. I think we've both been hedging a bit. My rating was also a 9 out of 10, and I am going to keep it at a 9 out of 10. I did really love rewatching this. I think as I think about what of these would I rewatch again in the future just for fun for me, this is definitely on the top of the list. Mine is 9 out of 10 bonnets, because the bonnets in this are killer.
Nice. Love it.
Yay.
Guys, we want to know what your rewatch through thoughts and notes are. What did you pick up on the 27th time that you've watched this movie that you didn't notice before, like the redwood trees in the background? So you can share those notes and tidbits with us. We are at Airbuds on social, and you can send us emails. We love talking to you guys there. Airbuds@gmail.com.
And you can also check those out. We are doing a palette cleanser next week. It is going to be a Halloween themed one. If you are listening to this on the day it comes out, which is Monday the 13th, I think. The 13th is Friday the 13th. How spooky.
Very spooky. It'll be Monday the 9th.
Monday the 9th is when this comes out. We will be doing a survey for what our palate cleanser should be, because we have watched too much Jane Eyre. It's all we talk about. It's all we think about. The Brontes are haunting my dreams. So we got to watch something else.
Yeah. And it's going to be something fall or spooky related.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the list we're looking at says All Hallows Eve, which is nice. Just a fun way of putting it.
You know what, Lillian? We could also pull in things that aren't necessarily like spooky, but more kind of like autumn-y. Kind of fall, so that might help you not be so scared. But either way, take a look at the list. Keep in mind that Lillian is spooked easily, and help us decide what we're going to watch.
Yeah, I'll remove anything that's too spooky for me.
Cool.
The
Exorcist.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you I have not The Exorcist. What is the one that I watch? Oh, I watched The Conjuring and I still have nightmares about it. And the last time I was at your house, Sam thought it would be funny to clap at me and I almost punched him in the face.
Nice.
But yeah, if you really have loved this show, first of all, we love you. We have a couple of incredibly nice 5-star reviews. We appreciate every single one that we get. If you write up something on Apple Podcasts, that is super helpful to us. We appreciate you all, and we will see you next week to talk about the big spooky Halloween situation.
So on that note, we'll see you guys later. Thanks for listening. Happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. Goodbye.
Bye.